Welcome to episode 182 of Sports Geek. On this week's episode, I chat with good friend, author, and futurist, Steve Sammartino.
Welcome to Sports Geek, the podcast built for sports digital and sports business professionals. And now, here's your host who lists Fletch as his favorite movie, Sean Callanan.
Thanks, DJ Joel. My name is Sean Callanan, and yes, Fletch, Chevy Chase, one of his best, is one of my favourite movies, and I do have a movie poster of Fletch, and I've just realised, and Steve, my guest, reminded me when he came into the office that it is not up in the office here at Creative Cube, so I'll have to rectify that. As always, thank you for listening. You might be doing so on iTunes. Actually, no, they call it the podcast app now. I think there's been an official release by Apple that say stop calling it iTunes, people. But you know where to get it, Apple folk. Or you might be listening it on Google Play, Stitcher, or my favorite app, Pocket Casts. As always, you can contact me at Sean Callanan on most platforms, or you can try via email, sean@sportsgeekhq.com. Or if you want to catch up with me at any time and have a chat and see how potentially Sports Geek can help you, you can simply go to sportsgeekhq.com/chat with Sean and book in a time. Stay tuned after this interview with Steve Sammartino because we've got a new download to help you with your Facebook ad campaign. So that's a little tease. So it's known in the game as a tease. Listen to after the interview. So Steve Sammartino is a good mate of mine. He's the author of the book, The Great Fragmentation, and his second book, which I highly recommend, The Lessons School Forgot. If you've been listening to the podcast for a long time, you might remember episode 29, where I caught up with 29, I think it is, back when I spoke to Steve about the Lego car. You can simply type in Lego car into the internet and look at that YouTube clip. I was part of a project with Steve. Steve's now a keynote, well sought after keynote speaker globally, talking about the trends and how the technology trends are affecting multiple industries. I've done podcasts with him before outside of Sports Geek. We did several podcasts on Beers, Blokes, and Business, talking about business and trends and what can happen. So I thought it'd be a good time to rekindle that that conversation and talk to Steve about trends in technology and how they might affect sports. So here's my chat with Steve Sammartino. Very happy to have a good friend, Steve Sammartino, futurist and author. You can find him on Twitter at Sammartino. I'm contractually obligated to mention his Twitter handle every time I introduce him. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Mate, there is no promotion without self-promotion. You know that, Sean. You're in the sports and sponsorship game, and you know it inside out, brother.
Yes. So Steve and I have done a lot of podcasts together. You may have listened to us way back in episode, I think it was 29, talking about the Lego car and the super awesome micro project. And now you are a two-time author and a keynote speaker, futurist, talking about the latest trends in the world and how technology is changing everyone's lives. And so what I want to do is, I guess, have the conversation with you around what are some of the trends and then how they're going to affect the world of sports.
Let's do it, mate. Sounds exciting.
So I guess, yeah, wanted to get started with you on how, you know, one of the big trends that's happened in the last 5 years in sport is the live experience and getting people to the game, the cheeks in the seats, as I say often on the podcast. What are you seeing, you know, in that space of, you know, experiential marketing, those kind of things on what people are looking for and the fact that there are, you know, so many options now for the customer?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I think about the idea of what people want in life now, and a large part of, as humans, what we want and what we do isn't just the experience itself, but it's what the experience shows. So we've got this world now where we've got every product that we could hope for. We've got houses full of stuff and garages that are full of stuff. And our garages are so full that we've got self-storage as the fastest growing real estate in the last 20 years in the US. And now what we look for is experiences for two reasons. First thing is there's only so much stuff you can have, and the enjoyment you get out of that is so temporary, and it's still the same thing after you've bought it, that I think experiences in sport, if you think they're big now, well, buckle your seatbelt because it's going to get bigger and more important. Experiences in our life are everything. It isn't just where you go and what you do. It's also, remember, we're all the CEO of our own personal media corporation. We want to show people how cool our life is, that we're at the Super Bowl, that we're at the grand final, we're at the event.
Yep.
And I think that the fact that sports is doing so well, this is actually the start of the start.
And so, you know, you sort of touched on that around, you know, where does technology, you know, and the biggest technology we've got at the moment is, you know, sitting in our pockets.
Yep.
And the
fact NASA that, in your pocket.
Exactly. And so, you know, and there is a bit of a to-ing and fro-ing in the world of sport of how much the experience should be to the person and how much should it be through the device. And, you know, there is a bit of the, are you getting distracted by all of these new technical widgets that you might be able to roll out? Where are you seeing one, both sports industry, but other industries sort of bringing in tech?
So I reckon it's the same whether it's a rock concert or a sport, right? The whole argument on should I be watching the game or looking at my phone and seeing the highlight and watching the thing that I just missed on the screen or taking a video of it and posting it. You know what I reckon? We've got to remember that now for the first time in history, we live in the choose-your-own-adventure.
Yep.
This is the choose-your-own-adventure world. Now, I know that you, Sean, because I'm often texting you when we're watching our favourite football team.
Yes.
And I know that even though I text you after I'm so excited after that goal was scored, expecting a response from you, I'm not going to get it until quarter time.
No.
I'm not going to get it until the break in the play because I know you're a guy who loves to watch the game in isolation and then go to the digital tools in the break.
Yep.
Now, I'm the guy that watches the digital tools because I've got young kids and I'm watching it at home.
Yep.
But the digital tools help me connect to you because you're at the game, or my brother, he happens to be at the game, and I try and connect with you guys to give me – at home, a bit of that live atmosphere by connecting with the tools. So that's one of the things that I love. But if we're a sports company that's out there or a sports organization, what we've got to do is remove our judgment and increase the options.
And it is very much because there's a bit of, you know, the silver bullet, this will solve it, everyone will bet. It's like, no, it's not everybody.
It's not. That's the point. And we've got to remember that back in the past where we were designing a singular product, you're designing cornflakes or you're designing a car, you've got to try and get it right for everyone because it's a physical product. And steel or bricks or concrete can't be in two places at once. Once you've molded it and developed it, that's it. But in a digital world, you know, zero-cost digital distribution, we can give a multitude of options to our audience and let them choose. Right? It shouldn't be, oh, you should be using the digital tool or you shouldn't not be using the digital tool. It's about optionality. And I love that idea that some people want to stay pure on the sport and then focus on the game live and then tweet or, you know, put it on Facebook or whatever afterwards. And then some actually like to be more integrated in it. But what we've got to do is embrace a myriad of tools and let people choose what suits them. And whatever they choose, we facilitate.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting we're seeing a bit of a bounce back. I think it was Chris Rock, Jack White's new tour, that they pretty much give you this pouch that locks up your phone.
Right.
That's
interesting, right? That's a good marketing point of difference, right?
Yeah, and so it's getting
they promote the event before it happens. You get the pouch.
Yeah, so you turn up, you effectively cloak your own device.
Right.
It gets locked in. You put it back in your pocket, but you can't be pulling it out now.
Is that to avoid people filming it and putting the content out there, or is that to make people
more attentive,
be more visceral and live in the experience? I mean, it's an interesting question.
I think it's a bit of column A and a bit of column B, to be honest. And it's a bit of a gimmick. It's a bit of a gimmick as well.
I like the gimmick idea because straight away you're getting some cut through because, as you know, mate, every day there's another event or another. I mean, the number of sporting events or general events, it's just out of control. It's just increasing, isn't it?
It was a technology concern early on. Like talking to a few of the people were rolling out the tech in stadiums right when Periscope was becoming
live,
a thing,
live
right?
Feeds, yeah.
And so the first thing they did was, oh, we'll block that app. We won't let people do live streaming from the.
And they found a way around it.
But the thing was, that, like, you know, watching it from your seat also was an amplifier. So it's a, you know, of, oh, well, I should be at the game and, you know, why shouldn't I be? All the stuff that Snapchat is doing where you can, you know, tune in and see all the different views from a big game. It's like, well, it's a different way to consume it.
What's happening down in the rooms before they come out, or what's happening in halftime. I mean, you know, this is really interesting because it comes down to the idea of we've got two sets of eyeballs as humans. If we have – everyone has another set of eyeballs in their pocket, I can almost be in any seat at any time. You know, and very soon, you know, we're probably going to have live cameras inside the ball of the sports game where I'm actually on the field, or a micro camera sitting on the headband of your favourite player who's, you know, on the court, you know, dribbling down the line, and I can actually have it. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting. So I think this idea to isolate the technology – so that we can keep the live performance and the revenue and not let people go against the TV rights that have been sold for billions of dollars to someone is kind of limited thinking.
Yeah.
Right? And the easiest way to think about that is to go back and to say, well, did sports grow or decline when TV arrived? Right? Like that's the first question. And then so if we follow on that line of thinking, will sports grow or decline with mobile technology, whether or not it's, you know, displaced small cameras inside balls or on players and GPS devices? Or
well, it comes down just to how the, I guess it probably the next point that I sort of had on the list of, you know, how the media world is changing.
So that's the problem. So if I was to come back to the primary problem right now, and in Australia here for the Australian listeners, we have the AFL's the biggest sport here, and you know what they sell? Digital rights and TV rights separately.
Yep.
It's almost embarrassing. It's 2018. That is a ridiculous viewpoint.
But that's a common one. Because the TV companies early, you know, in the last
early
5 years
yep.
or 5 years ago, they weren't in the digital game. And so it became that split.
Yeah.
And now what we're seeing is that correction of there's a bit of TV, you know, traditional TV companies like with their pants down going, oh, hang on, all of our consumers are going into a streaming OTT world.
Right.
And they're starting to be players in that space. But as they've turned up to the bidding war, they're like, oh, hang on, who are you? And there's Facebook to their right.
Oh, well, yeah,
There's Twitter to their left.
Yes.
There's Jeff Bezos over there with Amazon
and,
going on.
And then there's Hulu, and Netflix are saying, actually, we can participate in this because we're actually in more homes than Foxtel in Australia.
Well, and you know, and then you've got massive deals that you know, Disney just going and buying ESPN, you know, Major League Baseball, Advanced Media. So it becomes this completely different ecosystem.
Let's call it digital demarcation.
Yep.
So for you old unionists out there, you'd remember the demarcation. You're not allowed to work in an area that isn't that your union is in control of because we want to protect each other's jobs. Here's the thing that is so important for listeners to understand is that we now live in a what I call a horizontal economy. Now, what we used to live in was separate verticals or buckets where industries operated separately in their own supply chain.
Yep.
But now because we all use the same tools or factors of production, which is digital information, it's horizontalized. And you can't see my arm moving horizontally right now.
But everyone knows what horizontal looks like.
Right. They know what it looks like. Thank you, Sean. I knew you'd look after me. And so what's happened here is we're all using the same tool here. There is no digital.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, even your phone, you know, one of my favorite things is I laugh at when they say, you get this many phone calls and this much data. Guess what? It's all data. There is no phone calls and data.
Yeah.
It's the same stuff going through the phone lines. It's a big trick, right?
Yeah.
And so there is no digital TV and non-digital TV because all TV is digital.
Yeah.
So something that really needs to happen and needs to happen real quick is that rights in sports need – they just can't be sold in separate buckets because those buckets no longer exist.
Well, and also I think, you know, when they were ranked TV and digital, it was like digital was little brother.
Yeah, digital was this little upstart thing on
and
the side that
like,
was interesting.
Know,
let's have a little website on the side.
We're not too far away from that flipping.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
There's not
too – I think we're realising it. And it takes companies a while to adjust. And the other thing you have is these deals are often, you know, 2, 3, 5-year deals.
Or
and
8, 9, 10 years. Like these are really long –
Some of them are long lead deals. And we know, you know, with Moore's Law and other technology accelerating returns – that a deal, you know, the technology is doubling in power every 12, 18 months. And so a deal that made sense 3 years ago becomes outdated. You know, early on in that deal.
And that's where the, you know, that's where the changes are coming. You know, I do think, you know, that the Google, the Facebook, the Amazons, they might be the first bidder, and then they might do a deal with the more traditional TV stations.
That's right. So
the other thing is they might end up buying these TV stations because they're becoming media companies in their own right. So you don't know where the landscape's going.
They are. Google and Facebook, you know, they're not technology companies. They're media companies in disguise. And the only reason they claim to be non-media companies is to shirk the responsibility that goes with controlling media. I think we all know that.
I mean, it was.
And, you know, I'm an anti-Mark Zuckerberg guy. As powerful as his platform is, geez, he's a piece of work, that bloke.
Yeah, but, I mean, but then you look at.
So I didn't want to tell these people exactly how I felt there.
But that's okay.
Yeah, you compare him to Elon Musk, who actually, you know, wants to save climate change, and Mark Zuckerberg, who says, oh, we're not a media company, we're a platform. We don't employ journalists.
So we'll wind the conversation back. Okay. But because I do think it was. Quite funny that Rupert Murdoch, who is unashamedly a media guy, was making claims that that, you know, the social media companies like Facebook, Twitter, and that should be paying carriage fees,
carriage fees
in the same way that TV companies would be paying these carriage fees for the rights to be able to talk about, promote.
Which
is effectively, you know, like buying your TV license back in the 50s.
Back in the day, yep.
And, you know, he was calling them out as effectively as media companies, but it's like applying a 1960s philosophy to it. Yes. So
who's worse, Rupert Murdoch or Mark Zuckerberg, right? I don't know.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, the whole media, you know, and the sports rights place is, yeah, ever-changing. I mean, like just last week and talked to Josh Grunberg at Whistle Sports around what they're doing with some of the world's biggest YouTube creators and how it's a completely different media company than what previously been built to, you know, the LAFC guys sold their game rights to YouTube. And it's going to be on their YouTube Go subscription service.
See, I love that. I love that. That gets me excited on where your rights go to. There's something really interesting, and I know that you need revenue that's sustainable and predictable, right, to manage a sporting franchise or an organization or a sporting code, right? Because you need to say, look, we've got X amount of billions of dollars. Now we can run the show. We can set up the cameras. We can do the whole thing.
Yep.
But there's something weird about that setup where it goes to an old model where you have to subscribe or there's something about the on-demand world for sports that I think
it still
is missing
hasn't been
in some
solved.
Of the it hasn't been solved. And especially in some of the, I'm going to say, ball sport codes, you know, which might be football, basketball, baseball, all these types of areas where it's kind of all or nothing. I think they can learn a little bit from the UFC and the boxing with the pay-per-view. For me, that just seems right.
Well, there is so the NBA has brought in like single game purchases and those kind of things. And
I reckon I'd pay more to watch my sporting team in Australia, the AFL, because I don't sign up to the Foxtel. I would buy. And the game that I want to watch for $20, no problem. Yeah. I'll pay you the money. They don't even give me the option. So you know what I do? I steal it. Right? Yeah. They don't give me the option, so I'll go out and steal it.
And that's where, the user demand and the way that they're expected to consume has not caught up with the technology that's been rolled out. You know, we saw the same thing in music.
Because they're in love with yesterday instead of in love with tomorrow.
But we saw the same thing in music for a long while. People like just downloading and Napster was big.
Because they
and
wouldn't let someone buy a song. No, you have to buy the album.
And then iTunes just went and figured out and went, oh, this is how I buy a song. Oh, that's easy. Oh, Spotify, I can just buy a subscription and get it. So it's about putting those new models on.
And testing them. Why not testing it? So, you know, there's nothing wrong with a sporting code or an organisation that runs with a cable TV or a pay TV saying you can buy this game. And they still don't do it in, I understand, certainly in our country in Australia, but I don't know, what is it like in the US, Sean?
It's a bit the same. You know, it's still TV rights, drive subscriptions or you know, league pass, that kind of thing. So there's still that direct revenue model, you know, hey, we've bought the rights, you want access to this thing, you've got to go through our paywall, right?
Yeah,
which is pretty much the way.
Which is fine, but why not just sort of say, you can either pay $100 for a year or whatever the number is, or $30 a game. You know, I might end up spending $120 for four games and still be happier because I don't want to buy stuff I'm not getting. And I'm actually happy to pay a premium for the thing I want when I want it. You know, they need to learn from 7-Eleven, right? You pay $4 for a Coke because you want the Coke there and then that's cold, instead of going to the supermarket in advance and buying a six-pack of Cokes for $2.
Yeah, and that's where I think, you know, I did speak about it when I sort of reviewed the Mary Mika slides and stuff like that, and what's happening in China and India around how their digital ecosystem has evolved to having quick, micro, easy digital payments, which it hasn't happened in the, you know, the greater Western
the
world.
Market. You know, there's a really interesting point there, Sean, and I love this idea of industrial leapfrog. See, what happens is if you have a legacy industry with a mode that has worked for a number of years, we just kind of get so stuck on that and in love with yesterday. In the new economies, you know, and I go to China a lot and like India and Africa, because there's no legacy, they're open-minded. It's almost like they're not indoctrinated to yesterday's thinking.
Yep.
And that's why they're doing so well, because they're prepared to experiment. And you don't have these industries trying to stop it and say, no, we want it like it was yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, so that's where I think that potentially those models that are working and people just, you know, click a button and they buy, you know, order a taxi with the same app that they order their food with.
Exactly,
And they buy a digital
service. WeChat in China is crazily integrated.
Exactly. And that's the thing, you know, talking to Andrew Collins about that sort of space, like, you know, why isn't that type of integration? And again, we are like two steps away from Facebook saying, oh, click this button and you can buy that content. Like they're pushing into that media space.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, yes, they're making all their money with advertisers at the minute, but they're not, you know, they're not that far away from going, oh, that's a show I really like. Oh, yeah. I just have to click the button
buy
to pay
that
it.
Property.
And, you know, then they become a player right next to, you know, iTunes and Hulu and Amazon. That's where you purchase content.
Yeah, so absolutely.
I think it again, it's just taken, like you said, we're used to the old models.
And the power structures of the people who have the influence on government and control these companies and have the relationships, you know, with the big media and the sporting organisations, where, you know, they're too nervous to take a punt on piecemeal revenue versus consistent subscription revenue. But I think consumers have voted, and we've seen it in many industries already, that we want either all you can eat or to buy one item off the menu. This get in the middle bit of you get a subscription and you get this and you get that and you get the other, but you don't get that. That doesn't work. It's either you get everything for one price like Netflix, or you buy on demand like YouTube. iTunes. I meant to say iTunes.
So which sort of leads to another discussion, which was one of the points I sort of said, where does it fit in the world of sports? Because you were talking about big business, centralized rights, dictating to people how they should get it.
Yeah.
And then you have the buzz and the ups and downs that's happening around blockchain and cryptocurrency. And
wow.
It's like everyone goes, oh, there's a solution. Blockchain will fix everything, apparently.
You know what blockchain's going to fix, Sean? A lot of people don't know this. World peace.
Yeah, yeah.
Climate change.
It's got cancer in its
sights. No violence. Racism, like blockchain's going to solve every problem in the world.
So we're not just in that riff of blockchain is going to solve anything. What, you know, I love you as a futurist, and obviously people say, you know, hey, Steve, my crypto's going bananas. Oh, Steve, I've just lost my house because of crypto. It's just the last 6 weeks. You know, they're obviously asking you, how is blockchain going to potentially disrupt our industry? So can you give us a bit of what's your definition and how you explain it to people, and then we can sort of figure out where it might fit in sport?
I'm gonna start with an analogy, okay? If cryptocurrency and blockchain, if I was to separate the two and give an analogy we can understand, I would say that cryptocurrency is a website.
Okay.
And blockchain is the internet.
Okay.
All right. So cryptocurrency is a way that blockchain can be used. And weirdly, we invented blockchain technology to create the website, which is actually what happened on the internet. We wanted to share information, so we had to create the internet. But the real value of the cryptocurrency technology is the blockchain that sits underneath it.
Yep.
And so, as you know, cryptocurrency is a way of having a distributed currency that no one owns. The blockchain actually is a way of tracking and exchanging things of value. That's the way that I describe it. So it's not going to solve all the world's problems. But anything that requires a middleman or a middle person, sorry, I don't want to be misogynist, a middle person or an organization that is an authoritative figure or a stamp provider, that stuff can be circumvented by blockchain technology. So it enables two people to independently transact with each other using cryptography instead of an authoritarian figure. So anything that you go to someone in the middle, whether it's a bank or someone for a passport or whatever, that's where the blockchain comes in. And so for me, actually, it has a lot of really big implications for sport.
Yeah, so I mean, I can't remember if I've used it before, but I do record all of my I send it off to DJ Joel for the intros, and one of the ones that I wrote recently was, you know, I see a sports league or most likely a league or even a sport launching their own cryptocurrency to say we're going to launch this as a part of our ecosystem, and it might be for, you know, grassroots and how you interact in that space, but it also might up to be, you know, get into ticketing. Again, it is getting into the blockchain and cryptocurrency and the hype and that kind of thing. But is that something that potentially?
Look, I think you know, there's big opportunity within ticketing.
Yep.
And you know, the idea that scalping is an interesting idea.
Yep.
So the idea of scalping being avoided through blockchain technology is a good one. That's where we could find out, you know, keep track of who had the tickets and where they came from and whether or not it's real or false tickets. That's one of the solutions.
So it could fix fraudulent
fix fraudulent tickets. Another thing that could be interesting is if we think about the way the internet operates now with likes and follows and shares, putting that type of stuff on a blockchain for an industry or a sport could create its own system, ecosystem of value.
So it potentially could get into that space of loyalty. In the space of, I go to my game.
I'm the most loyal fan.
Yeah.
So I'm the most loyal fan of the New York Yankees or the Collingwood Football Club or Manchester United. And every interaction that I have that promotes or does something for the club gets tracked and I get value for that. And that value could become some sort of a frequent flyer point that I can cash in with the club because I'm supporting and working for the club, for example. And that would be immutable, transferable, anonymous, and tracked on the blockchain beautifully. So right now we've got this whole sort of, it's hard to use and hard to understand. As we move up the learning curve and we find technology solutions, because the blockchain technology is a bit slow at the moment. That's one of the core challenges. When we get around that, I think we're going to see tokens and coins for different industries where we can trade and transact value within an ecosystem and then bring the money back out into our normal fiat currency to create the value later.
Yeah, and that's the piece, because it's that ecosystem piece. So, you know, talking to the guys at Unicorn who are in the esports, fantasy and gambling space, like it made, because they were building, you know, they had an ecosystem of people playing games and deciding who was going to win in the esports space. It made sense for them to launch their own Unicorn Gold, the cryptocurrency, to say this is how we're going to do it inside our system.
Yeah.
And then the extension that is, then you can come to a Las Vegas casino, use our currency, and so it becomes an ecosystem. And I think it's a really good –
that's what currencies are. Currencies are basically ecosystems of tracking value.
Yep.
That's what a currency is. A currency is everything to do with value created and trust exchanged. And so if we can do that with blockchain technology and track it on our phones, then it opens up all sorts of opportunities to grow industries and we can trade it back out into our normal currency. I actually don't think we'll use the cryptocurrencies necessarily to trade in the real world and, you know, buy hot dogs necessarily or, you know, clothing or
so it will
normal
be,
things we buy.
Yeah.
I think it'll end up as little eco-trading systems that we use to create value and then we trade it out. Almost a little bit like frequent flyer points.
That's a
really good example of, I think, how it could, in a less complex way, we could have a frequent flyer point mentality that goes into all manner of industries that we happen to interact with or be loyal with. And if you might remember a few years ago, Sean, and I'm sure the listeners would, you know, about 5 or 6 years ago, gamification was a real trendy word in business.
Yep.
How can you track followers in sport and create incentives?
Yep.
Well, I think the blockchain might have been the missing link to that entire idea.
Yeah, I was early. We launched one in 2011.
I remember and we talked about it. We had the fan base. What did you call it?
It was Digital Cheer Squad, that's right. And we did it with the Minnesota Timberwolves, and it was early, and we were tracking
hashtags too early, mate.
And that kind of thing. And there's still people that are doing that space. But yeah, that's exactly that point.
Yep.
One of the last points, I want to go back to a conversation I had with Darren Birch at the AFL and some of the stuff that they're doing in planning like their next 20 years. And again, putting that future view of where the AFL might be. And one of the things that he talked about was looking at the Australian market, and it's like, cool, we've got our fans. We know who they are. Mm. But where's growth? And what will – and so the two things that were a real big focus for him were where were the 6, 7, 8-year-olds? What are they going to be looking at when they turn 20?
Wow.
And then the other one was immigrants, new immigrants.
Yeah.
So – you know, I've got, I've had my kids go through and become young adults. You've got young kids yourself. Yep. Where do you think they'll go?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. And Sean's, while he's having a little cough there, where do you think we'll go? He's having some water now, people. Just visualize this. And so, you know, culture is the most powerful thing and sustainable thing in our society. It's the most immovable and immutable thing. So I'm teaching my kids. They don't have a choice on the team that they break for. You know that, Sean. They break for Collingwood, and we're going to go to our first games this year. Like, they're in.
Well, you come sit next to us.
And so if the AFL or any code wants to grow, you've got to give the parents a reason to indoctrinate children.
Yep.
Right. I reckon indoctrination sounds terrible, sounds semi-religious, right?
It does a bit.
But this idea of indoctrinating and giving people a tool so that they can introduce something of value to them, to their new cohort is going to become incredibly valuable. And the immigrants is a really good one. Mm. I really take my hat off to what the AFL did in the final series last year, where they had different languages calling the game and stuff, because it gives people a sense of belonging when they arrive. I mean, you don't move your whole family to a new country just for the sake of it. You want to integrate. You want to be part of something. You want to feel like you're part of it. But I'll tell you a personal story to me that really mattered about getting children into a sport and a franchise, and then I'll tell you about the tech side of it and the future side. So the first personal side is this. The Essendon Football Club came down to where my boy goes to kindergarten, right? And they gave him a football and a T-shirt and everything.
Yep.
And I proceeded.
Fan development, right?
Yep. And an incredible strategy. Let me tell you how powerful it was. My boy came home so excited because the AFL players came there and kicked the ball with him and gave him a T-shirt and everything, and he started barracking for Essendon. Now, when he was in bed that night, I proceeded to throw all that stuff in the bin because that's my job as a valuable dad. And my wife was a little bit angry, and I sat her aside and I said, listen, I have to tell you this, Shen. Here's how it rolls. What's the most important thing in our house? Is it our family? She said, yes. She agreed. I said, so right now you will notice that every now and again I go to the football with my dad and my brother, and it's one of the most beautiful, powerful things that we value. And that couldn't happen in the same way if we didn't break for the same team. My family need to break for the same team because it gives us a lifetime connection that we'll have forever. And I really mean this deep down in my heart.
Yep.
Right. And so I'm going to take him down to the Collingwood training and get him some Collingwood gear and meet the players and sign the thing to get through that. So that family side of it and that connection, that social cultural connection, is how you keep it going. In terms of technology, there's a real challenge.
So, I completely agree with you on the family side. And I think it is, again, looking at the total overall market from a global point of view, I think Australia and the UK, Europe scene, from a fan base point of view, it's very much
family handed down.
It's handed down, right? Yeah, and you are directed, indoctrinated is the right word.
Yeah.
I think that also happens in the States. Like you have fans that are
generational,
right?
You grow up, you do it
but
together.
There's also the other side of it is there is that entertainment. You know, it is sport as entertainment.
Yeah,
and there's not as strong as tie. And sometimes it's even in the language, like in the fact that I talk about the Australian market. Use does it very well. It started with the AFL, NRL are now doing it. It's now at guilt level marketing, Right. I go, yeah. Oh, Steve, you work for Collingwood. Are you a member yet? They don't have to. You know, there's no marketing required because I'm a member and I'm going to make you a member I'm going to shame you to not be a member. And so whereas in, you know, in the US, they'll be called season ticket holders. So you're just someone that holds a bit of plastic.
Yeah.
Whereas in Australia, you're a member. And so we've seen, you know, teams in the US.
I think members are much better
It gives
than
you
ticket holder. It's you're a, part
it's
of a, something.
It's an ownership and identity piece that's really important. But from a, you know, the interesting bit from the, you know, from that is, you know, how the kids.
Yeah, I think the thing that really sticks out to me is sport and entertainment and the overlap. So I think the sporting codes to do well need to understand that their competition isn't other sports. Their competition is entertainment. And entertainment could be movies. Entertainment could be video games. And here's what I think
it could be all those media outlets we talk about.
Right. And so let's think about, the media outlets as well. So, you know, it's
Netflix and Hulu
and Facebook. So here's what you've got to do, right? If you try and compete, you lose. If you try and collaborate, then you become part of the shift. All right. So let's think about the people who fought the MP3s and the people who went with it. All right. Don't fight the tide. So if that means that in some way your sport needs to be more integrated with entertainment or movies or something, then you need to move in it. You actually need to blur the lines. The more you blur the lines between what you are in sport and entertainment, the more you can survive. Because unless you're at the table with where the change happens and where the kids go tomorrow, you're not going to be part of the conversation and you can't shape it.
And I think, you know, talking to Aviv around the video technology that he's supplying into the NBA, in the fact that, you know, they went from sharing 300 videos across all of their channels to having this technology that picks out the highlight, knows what this highlight, knows it's a really great highlight, and it just gets shared. And they've gone from like that to 1,500 videos being shared on all these different channels. It's just, you know, and that it's almost omnipresent. That's like a massive dunk happens and it's like, I'll just have to open my phone and every platform will have some version of that and it's in my face. And they've taken that approach of making sure it's everywhere and everyone sees it to other leagues that have been more traditional, like sitting at, you know, cease and desist letters that restrict
right.
it.
And that's the old world, isn't it? You're not allowed to use it. So it's like this idea of, I used to call it channelology. So you've got to let people choose their own channel, right? And so if you want the kids to be into your sport with tech, be where they are and be agnostic.
Yep.
Don't think in terms of buckets or channels. Just put it wherever they are and let them choose and let them arrive, let them come in.
And that's where it will be. We'll see, you know. I remember, you know, my kids early on playing, you know, computers and they'd be sitting there waiting for the desktop to load up to play some game, right? Yeah. And that's what it was. You know, this is when my kids were little, whereas your kids can pick up an iPad, click two buttons and watch something, right? Just have like no problems with it. And, you know, now my teenage kids, adult kids now, they consume most of their content on YouTube, right? And that's where they're getting it. So that whole channelology, you know, the AFL, the NFL, the NBA, they have to be on those channels.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they'll never get.
They're still a bit singular. They're still too singular. You cannot be singular. You've got to be horizontal. If you're horizontal, you participate. If you're singular, you don't. I mean, I think the EPL in the UK did a great job really early on by getting into gaming and, you know, the PS games and all that kind of stuff. And the way they integrated, you know, the FIFA sport and everything, you know, right across every year it was the update. They were in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not surprised that the EPL is such a big sport because I actually reckon the way they've done it's been really smart.
Well, you know, FIFA overall, it's like it's becoming such a value piece for all the leagues worldwide that they're now doing jersey sponsor reveals.
Right,
they're now doing player celebrations in stadium of the game version, not the live version.
There you go.
Right? So it's a bit, it's the connecting of I play the game, I see it. And the fact that, again, go back to Mary Meeker, the fact that actual players are watching and playing the game to help them visualise to play, like it's again, it's that message to fans.
And here's some advice for anyone in the AFL out there. Here's what you got to do. Every year there needs to be a different away jersey for every team that is collectible with the year on it. And even Collingwood, who I break for goodness sake, you're missing it. Geez, you're missing the revenue opportunity here. Do I have to come there and put the money in your pocket? Get a different jersey every year with a different colour on it that you can sell. I mean, that's 101.
I mean, we've seen that with the NBA done its new deal with Nike. They come out with four editions, and it's like, well, I'm a fan.
You've got to be a fan. You've got to collect them, man. You've got to collect it because as humans, we're collectors.
So for people who don't know, before you became a futurist, speaker, author, you spent a lot of time in the advertising game. And when I said, hey, let's come on and talk about the future, you're like, I want to talk about the future, but give me a platform to talk about Super Bowl ads.
There it is.
So the Super Bowl was on recently and you wanted to talk about Super Bowl ads. Well, what do you want to talk about?
Well, it's really interesting for me. I actually reckon it's one of the few times that advertising works.
Yep.
In the modern world, right? And the organisations out there, the sporting organisations and companies, they need to realise there are very few things that aggregate people around a screen to watch together. It just doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, I mean, Gary Vee still calls it a pretty good, good buy because you're getting that.
It is a good buy because no one is watching at that time, 7:30 p.m. Friday night, like they are with sport. It's the only thing left. Yep. There's nothing left. You know, even Big Bang Theory gets 20 million people in America. It's like, well, I can watch it on demand or whenever I want or later on. There's very few things that are time-based. Sport's the only one left.
Yep.
And Super Bowl advertising, I still reckon, is incredible value, not because everyone's watching it. The ads actually become their own ecosystem that people want to watch and tech and ad people want to see them.
They've waxed and waned on the, we're going to release it 2 days before.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, did you see that Darth Vader Volvo ad? It's I've seen it 3 days before, but then it appears. Yeah. And then you have, the Australian tourism.
It got a lot of cut through, didn't it?
Got a lot of cut through doing the Dundee PR movie. Oh, no, it's just an ad piece.
Yep.
And it's like, there's a debate here in Australia of did we pay too much, for it and all of this thing. But it's like there's a lot of people
talking.
So pay
TV and free-to-air TV, their advertising model is incredibly broken except for live sports. It's the only thing left. And so the idea of – and I had in my first book, The Great Fragmentation, where I talked about the future of advertising. And I said the only time advertising ever works – on a TV platform is going to be when it's live, and that's still true to this day. And that's the one benefit that sports can leverage to the nth degree because the game is the game. You know, if I think about the biggest sporting event
the
last year,
it's the ultimate reality TV.
It's the ultimate reality TV. You know, the McGregor fight last year, Mayweather McGregor, that was unbelievable. Like, I was at this kid's party when it was on live on a Saturday, I think it was a Sunday afternoon, and he was having this big argument about his wife. The fight's just started. When are we leaving? It was like a 6-year-old kid's party, and he was going ballistic, and there was this big hoo-ha about it because he wanted to go see it live, and he couldn't look at his phone because he was scared that there was a pop-up on it and everything. I mean, that's the benefit of live sports and advertising. Yeah, and the Super Bowl, I think it still kills as an idea for live advertising. You know, I think it's incredible. And I was sitting down watching the ads. I was as excited about the ads.
Yeah.
Well, actually more excited being an ex-ad man than I was about the game itself.
And the Super Bowl is the pinnacle for the ad space. Like they've built it up for that piece to say this is the best thing, but also – from an ad point of view, you should be debuting on this space. So I think
even Jeff Bezos got his head in this year, hey? Yeah. Bezos wanted to get his rock star on.
Yes, with the Alexa ad. So, it is interesting. One of the things I wanted to, pick your brain a little bit on being a futurist, and we are looking at the time and understanding that I've made the agreement to pay your parking fine should we go over. As a futurist, how do you stay on top of trends?
You know, it's actually one of the nerdy things that I do is I read a lot of university and white papers. So if I see something, I've got alerts set up on Google. So Google alerts, your world's best friend. So I have a certain tech categories of things that there's a lot happening on.
Yep.
So I have alerts on that. And if there's an interesting white paper that comes out of MIT or one of the good universities on, the future, a new battery technology, I'll quickly read it and just get my head around it pretty quickly.
Yep.
Wired magazine is still, I think, the best magazine and journal for what's happening in the future. Just by such a long way, it's not even funny.
Okay.
Because they don't just tell you what's happened, they tell you what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that's way more important because tactics are disposable and trends are valuable. And they go through that. The other one is I try and get my fingers dirty. I've got to get dirt under the fingernails. So you've got to make projects and experiment with the technology. So I'm always trying to make something, do a bit of that. And I'm doing a blockchain project, which we'll talk more about later. But, to get my head inside the tech, you've got to make something. Because as everyone listening knows, it's one thing to study it. But when you run a project or do something, you go, oh, gee, I thought this and, gee, I learned that by touching it.
Yep.
So basically read one book a week. on some sort of tech topic that's been recommended for through a friend or someone that I trust. I'll read a book a week, and to read a book a week is really easy. The average book takes 7 hours to read at normal reading speed, and I read for an hour each day. And I don't read when I go to bed. You know when I read? 11 till 12 during the day, or 2 till 3 when I'm awake and I can concentrate on it because it's part of my job.
Yep.
You know, it's part of my job. So I read a book a week, I read Wired magazine, read a few white papers and do projects. So that's how I keep on top.
Terrific. Terrific. So as an author, I'm planning to document what I do from a sports geek point of view and helping teams understand their digital footprint, how they can go about selling it and go through the process we go through. What advice do you have for me?
You know, being an author, writing the book is hard and letting people know about it is harder. So I'm glad you mentioned it now. What you got to do is work with the audience in the lead up to the book so they know what's coming. You can get feedback from them on what to write and let them know that's out. You almost got to drip feed a book in a long time before the launch. And that's what I've learned over two books, and I need to get better at it myself. And so I think a large part of writing a book is almost like you got to take the audience on the writing journey as you write it.
Yep.
Actually, one of the people who I think does it really well is Nassim Taleb.
Yep.
Who wrote the book The Black Swan, which was pretty famous, a New York Times bestseller, and he did Fooled by Randomness and Anti-Fragile. He's got a new book called Skin in the Game, which I think comes out now-ish or in a week or two. And I really love the idea. It's like, don't trust opinions from people who haven't got skin in the game. And I just love that conceptually. It's great. Yep. And he's been sharing little pieces of the book for the last year and a half.
As he's going through.
As he's writing it and getting feedback and talking about stuff and doing that on Twitter. And, he can be a bit abrasive of a person to follow. But the way he's done that has been really something to be lauded. The other thing that he does really well, and I remember getting this advice off Seth Godin, is that – and who signed off on my first book or did a blurb for it. He said that the best books, you can describe what they're about without having to read them.
Yep.
I'm not saying that facetiously, but the idea of the long tail, right? Mm. Anyone can tell you what the long tail is without having to have read it.
Yep.
You know, people can tell you what the tipping point is without actually having read the tipping point.
Yep.
And so that gives people a cognitive shortcut or understanding on what it is.
Yep. And I think you definitely nailed that in your second book.
The lesson school forgot, right?
You know,
which is all that cool stuff that you're like, why didn't they teach me this in school? You know, about your future and your job and finance and all that. So that's what I did on my second one.
And so check out the book. I mean, as I said to Sema, he did interrupt my Facebook Live the other day calling me while I was on, but he got a shout-out for the video.
No, so I appreciate it, mate. I just need to call you five times a day so I get that shout-out every time.
So one of the things that we do for the end of the podcast interview is the Sports Geek Closing Five. Sometimes I prep people and they give them the questions.
My eyes have just gone like dinner plates. Doesn't know.
So do you remember – and so because people go – I'm happy to have a conversation, but sometimes they freak out with the last five. So I haven't prepped you, so full warning.
I don't know what it is now. But
you've known from this conversation, Steve is very good at handling any question. Do you remember the first sports event you ever attended?
Yeah, I do. Do you mean official one or localised?
It's your answer.
My first ever sporting event was a Collingwood game at Victoria Park. And it was Collingwood versus Melbourne, and it was the first ever AFL football match that I went to. And
it would have been VFL at the time.
It was VFL, and I remember.
How old were you?
I would have been, I reckon, 5 years old, so it would have been about 1970-something, 79.
And so, did you stack the steel tin cans?
Mate, I couldn't see the whole time. I remember there was a lot of swearing, and Mum was like, don't worry about those words, son, putting her ears over, because this is back in the dark old days.
Yeah.
And I remember after the game, everyone could run on the field then and try and touch the players before the end of the game.
The only thing
I can remember is running out on the field and getting mud all over me, and Mum being so cross that me and my brother had mud all up our jeans.
Fond memories of Victoria Park, standing on the tin cans so you can see.
I didn't see much of the game because I was too little. And this is when you didn't have seats. It was standing room only.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you do go to a sports event, or if there might have been a few different places you've been, do you have a favourite food memory or a go-to food when you go to the footy?
It's got to be pie with sauce.
Pie with sauce?
I want pie with sauce. I want it to be just the right temperature. It just burns my mouth a little bit to give me a memory when I go home. And now that I'm older, I get a beer in a plastic cup. So me and my brother, it's like, who's getting the beer? And who's getting the pie? And you get a pie and a beer and you eat it, and it's just, mate, yeah, it's one of the great moments in cold Melbourne weather.
It is. And it is it's something about the pie warmer that somehow it gets the pie too hot in the middle.
Too hot in the middle and a little bit cold, and it tricks you. So your body gets
What's the first app you open in the morning?
First app I open in the morning is the Surf Report. See what the waves are like. And just fantasize about whether or not I'm going surfing.
And then do you check then Sneaky Surf to see what's available?
Yeah, I sometimes go, but I only go into Sneaky Surf on the weekends every time, because that's when it tends to be busy. And weirdly, the app that I open the most, just hoping that it might be good like it was in the past, is Twitter, yeah. which I still open that first for some reason.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is a bit of one, check who's pinging you.
Yeah, that's what I do. And I always go to the at. I don't look at the feed. I look at the at in case, because my view is social media is you reach out to me, I'm going to answer you every time. Just test me out there, listeners, at Sammartino. I answer everyone every time. So I always test to see if anyone wants to chat to me.
You have given a few names, but is there in who you follow? But is there someone that you would suggest that the podcast listeners should follow, and why? Just to stay up on trends, just interesting. Whether it's an author, someone on Twitter, or something like that. Who would you say you should be following?
Look, I still say Seth Godin and Daylight.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, there's Gary Vee and all these other guys out there talking about tech. Seth Godin is the smartest guy that gets the humanity, the technology, the finance. He just gets it.
And he's just prolific.
And prolific and smart and giving and generous. Man love going on there. Actually, but, you know, if I were to look at someone who really understands what's happening with the trends of technology, I'd say Kevin Kelly.
Yeah.
His work is really exceptional. And he was one of the founding fathers of Wired magazine.
Well, I mentioned Kevin Kelly because you have talked about him before around the around again when I started talking about the book idea. It's like the 1,000 fans.
Yeah, true. Well, yeah, and Kevin Kelly, you guys might know this one, is that he came up with the concept of 1,000 true fans, which means you've probably got to have 10,000 people following you to get 10% of them, right?
Yep.
And if you have 1,000 true fans, they'll like your content and invest in you like they would a sports club, right?
Yep.
And give you a certain amount of their money, not because they're being generous to you, but because you're worth it and you give good value and you make their life better.
So the last one is getting you to choose your social media platform MVP. We don't let people sit on the fence. Which platform is working for you the best right
LinkedIn,
now?
LinkedIn by a million miles. It is day and night. It's not even close. Now, I've transitioned from Twitter. Blogging was probably the one that gave me the most value for the longest time. But blogging, as you know now, everyone is kind of doing their blogging on other platforms. Now I'm doing micro blogs, two or three of them every day on LinkedIn. So follow me, Steve Sammartino, on LinkedIn. I do blogs on all manner of tech and, you know, thinking stuff every day, little photo things, experiences that
I've
had.
And after we've spoken today, you're going to start doing some video.
Yeah, I'm going to start doing more video this year. Heaps of video, but yeah, LinkedIn, I mean, it's just so valuable because I think we've all realized that while there's a lot of things we'd like to know about on LinkedIn, we follow the people who care about the things that we care about, and it's actually a little bit like Twitter used to be.
Yep.
It's people in your industry who can share information that's of value to them and of value to you. And it's, look, we don't need to see, you know, photos of each other's kids or birthday parties. We're here to do business. We do business. We educate and help each other, and it's great.
So, yeah, I completely agree. I've loved where
LinkedIn – and I wasn't an early fan of LinkedIn. Early days I hated it, and now I love it.
Well, I mean, it was about this time last year I said, start taking it seriously, start seeing what happens
there. And
you've
seen it, mate, and it's incredible.
Yeah. I've been a big fan for LinkedIn a long while, but I really have loved what the tweaks they've done in the last 12, 18 months.
Actually, and they're going to take up – you know, I would be flummoxed if they really don't fill that void – on Facebook business pages is all going to go to LinkedIn, I think.
Yeah, but it's also what we were talking about before. You know, you go to Facebook, you know, to keep up with your friends and your family, and you stalk the people you went to high school with, right? Yeah. And it's in that personal.
Yeah,
it's your 5 p.m. onwards. It's your weekend platform. But LinkedIn is your 9 to 5, Monday to Friday.
And that suits what I do because I don't really share a lot of my social life really other than a bit of the surfing.
Yep.
And stuff that's looks social but it's really sort of more my work. I'm more a work guy online.
Yep.
And so LinkedIn's perfect.
Yep. Well, I will make sure all the links to connect with Steve at Sammartino, stevesammartino.com, The Lessons School Forgot on all good book platforms, but really you're just going to go to Amazon and click go.
Of course.
Thank you very much for catching up.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed the chat.
Want to start driving more revenue from digital? Go to sportsgeekcampaigns.com.
Thanks again to Steve Sammartino. As he said there, he replies to all these tweets. So if you are on the Twitter, send him a tweet at Sammartino. As I said, absolutely smart guy. One of the smartest guys I know. Always love catching up with Sammer. Always learn something when I catch up with him. And if you are looking for some inspiration in your career or just trying to rethink how your career and how the world's moving, I really do suggest getting a copy of The Lessons School Forgot. It can really reframe your thinking and what you can do in the world, whether you want to be an entrepreneur or if you just want to be a game changer in your current job. So that's it for this episode. A quick few plugs that I did mention. I'm doing a lot of athlete digital training at the minute. So if you have a playing group or a coaching group that wants to understand the digital platforms and how they can use them, get an update on what's happening on the social media platforms from an athlete perspective, and how they can find out the appropriate social media platform for themselves, as well as some ideas around content and understanding privacy concerns and security concerns, and also handling trolls, which is one of the major problems of athletes. Please get in touch. We're doing it for a few different playing groups at the minute, so I thought I'd put that out there. I'm happy to do that session. Really like connecting with athletes and finding out how they're using the platforms. As I did in the episode, I really should turn alerts off when I'm doing the intros and outros. I've just slightly got distracted, but back on task. We've got a new Facebook guide out. So for those of you who did download the Facebook data guide, which was a big hit for helping people understand the power of data, that was a free guide that you can help you understand your audiences, understand what Facebook knows about your fan base. If you haven't downloaded that, you can go to sportsgeekhq.com/FBdata. So we've done a follow-up. So now that you have got you've created these awesome audiences and awesome targets and you've found some real nice niches for my American friends that you can run some campaigns to, you're now into the point of, well, how do we run the campaigns? So we've written a book about it. We've written a book about Facebook campaigns and how you can go about building Facebook campaigns. It's the exact process that we use when running campaigns for ourselves, whether it's running campaigns to promote the podcast or Sports Geek content, as well as campaigns that we run from a ticketing point of view, from a merchandise point of view, season tickets, membership messages. So it takes you through a lot of the mechanics of naming conventions and why you do it to also what you should be looking for in copy and images and those kind of things. And we're going to change it up a little bit. This book, which you'll be able to get at sportsgeekhq.com/FB campaigns, you can go get it now for free for the next week. By the time you listen to the next episode of Sports Geek, it will then go on sale for $9.95. So again, this is just me testing the market, testing, I guess, the opportunity. I'm not doing it as a big money maker, but it is about, I guess, testing the market of whether it wants this kind of content and what they'll be willing to pay. So as a podcast listener, you get in first and you get in for free. You've got 7 days to download it. This is a real big test to see whether podcast listeners follow up and sign up. And I know you do because you've signed up for Sports Geek News or you've joined the Sports Biz Slack. So I know you do. So I wanted to make sure that as a loyal listener, you get this book for free. I'd love your feedback. So that's sportsgeekhq.com/campaigns for the next 7 days, you will be able to download that for free and better execute your campaigns and get the one of the big things that these campaigns can do is get the cheeks in the seats, get people into your stadium. So that's it. One last thing, an update on the book, as I was discussing with Steve Sammartino there. He is an author. I am hoping to be one this year. I met with a book publisher this week, so now we have a green light. So now I'm in the process of pulling together that content, coming up with vital things like name of the book and those kind of things, but it's pretty much working through the steps, the five-step process that we've got around audience, content, distribution, value, and then your pitch. I'm going to start producing that content. I'll be sharing some of that content both with you as podcast listeners, also in the Sports Biz Slack community. I might ask a few people to review some chapters and some of the pieces as we develop it. It is very much the process that we go through in our workshops around helping teams better understand their content and actually start driving digital value. So I'm really excited about building that. If you're interested, if you'd like to know more, if you just want to support it, please get in touch. Sean at sportsgeekhq.com will get me via email. As I said, at Sean Callan and on all other channels. So until next episode, my name is Sean Callanan, and you've been listening to Sports Geek.
Join over 1,000 sports business executives in Sports Biz Slack. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/slack. Please share your fave episodes of Sports Geek on LinkedIn. Be sure to tag Sean Callanan.
Go to sportsgeekhq.com for more sports digital marketing resources.
Want to chat with Sean? Book a time for a call. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/phone call.